If you have any concerns about recording, please do let us know, or if you don't want to have your comments read out or anything, please let me know. We make the slides and we make the recordings available on our website afterwards, and we know that they get a good set of views after that, so please do encourage folk, if they're not able to join this meeting, to go to the website afterwards. Please keep your muted throughout. If you came in already, I will have muted you as you came in, but if you can remember to keep it off as we go through the presentation, that's really helpful for recording purposes. And you may want to turn your video off because sometimes we get some bandwidth issues. We're happy to tweet for this, so if you're interested and want to do that, please do so. The hashtag that we use is hashtag AOASG webinar, all one word, and you can follow us on openaccess_ANZ, where we'll be tweeting along. Mandy and her colleagues are going to do an interactive discussion as they go through, but I will also take questions at the end. And so if you have a question that you'd like to give to Mandy or her team, please type it into the chat box or put it onto Twitter and I'll read it out at the end. We should have about 20 minutes for general questions. And then, of course, just to say, always very happy to hear any other suggestions for blogs or webinars going forward, but hope you find this one interesting and informative. So our presenters today are from Toha Toha in New Zealand. I'm going to hand over to Mandy Henk, who's the chief executive there, and she's going to introduce herself and the team. And then, as I said, at the end, I'll take back and the opportunity for people to ask questions. Thanks very much, Mandy. Handing over to you now.
Hi. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Mandy Henk. I am a librarian, and I've been involved with the open access movement in some way or another, really going all the way back to about 2004 or so. In 2004, I took my first permanent professional job, and I was responsible for course reserves and interlibrary loan and a few other things at the Vanderbilt Law Library. And those who have been around for a while will remember that back in 2004 is when we really got into digitizing course readings and sharing interlearns digitally. Obviously, there at the time wasn't a clear legal framework for that, which is how I ended up falling into the copyright and licensing and then eventually open access. And much of my career has really been about helping to open up information to people and helping to ensure that the legal framework surrounding that were things that really made sense to folks. So we're going to do this as a sort of interactive session. I am going to go ahead and start sharing my screen with you and hand you off to Brendan, who is our comms manager. Oh, I'm sorry, no, Dione first. Dione, would you like to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Kia ora, everyone. Ko Dione Joseph Aho. I am Mandy's strategic advisor, and I'm a very recent acquisition to the Toha Toha movement, but I've been quite invested in this area, both as an academic and also someone who's worked in the public sector for the last 3 years in New Zealand's public sector and in the heritage and culture sector for the last 12 years. So my role is to support Mandy in a variety of different objectives that we have for Toha Toha. And I'm really excited to meet you all. And I hope you really enjoy this presentation, because I know it offers a really unique insight into te ao Māori and how we communicate and engage with our Māori and Pacifica and other ethnic communities, but also how we're uniquely located to share information, create information, and innovate with it in Aotearoa New Zealand. So that's it from me, and I will hand back to you, Mandy.
Excellent. Brendan, would you like to introduce yourself and also confirm that you are in fact seeing my presentation?
Yes, I can confirm I'm seeing your presentation, and all our faces are right there on screen. I hope everyone can hear me okay. Introducing myself, I'm the comms manager now for Toha Toha. I've been on board for about 3 months. Come on board as a freelancer who does business writing and PR consultancy. I've been doing that I've been a PR consultant for about 12 years or so. Mostly I've done PR in the tech space, so tech companies, local and global. Probably most recently, I did 3.5 years as a comms manager at Microsoft, and the concept of open source software and everything like that was a frequent kind of topic of conversation when I was there at Microsoft. So I'm very excited to be part of the Toa Toa team now and learning a lot about open licensing, everything like that. And great to be here, particularly for this new phase of the journey under the new name, which we're going to be getting to here today. Now, part of what I'm going to be doing here is I will be we'll be doing this in an interview format. I'll be interviewing Mandy, and she'll be able to do all of the sharing of things as we go. So I guess that's probably a good enough cue for us to get into it. So I'm going to throw straight back to Mandy with a question here about what are we even doing here, Mandy? I'm going to ask you to take it away.
Excellent. So I was hired here by back when we were Creative Commons Aotearoa New Zealand, back when we were CCANZ. One of the first things that I actually did was some strategic work. And what we decided to do is to adapt the vision and mission statements from the Creative Commons Global Network and sort of make them more New Zealand-y, make them more appropriate for an Aotearoa context. And I actually think that the vision and mission statements are profoundly important. A lot of times the open movement doesn't always have a clear understanding of what the underlying vision is. Sometimes we get a little bit focused on strategy. So what we really want to do is to help to realize the full potential of the internet. And when we say universal access, we really do mean universal access. We want everyone to be able to participate in the internet, and we want to ensure that the things that we produce here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, are shared and are able to be shared widely around the world. So that's sort of who we are and what we do at a sort of really big picture level.
Great. Well, let's compare with where things started. Tell us about CCANZ. What was that?
So CCANZ started, 10 and a half years or so ago. And what we were is we were part of what was going to be a Humanities Council for New Zealand. We are the last organization standing from that attempt. Those who have been around for a long time will remember the old days of the licenses. When the licenses first started, the Creative Commons licenses, they had to be ported into local law. So in order for the licenses to be legally robust in a given legal jurisdiction, in this case New Zealand, a whole bunch of lawyers had to sit down and they had to do like some legal work, right? They had to make licenses that worked with New Zealand law. And that's really the genesis of our organization. We have been, I think by any standard, wildly successful at not only making sure that the licenses are legally robust, which with the advent of 4.0 is not work that we need to worry about anymore, but also ensuring that Creative Commons licenses are widely used here in New Zealand. For those who don't know the New Zealand government open access and licensing framework, or how the New Zealand government shares information with the public, relies on the Creative Commons licenses. So because we have Crown copyright here, so much of what the government produces is actually covered under copyright, we help to ensure that there's a legal framework for the government to share things legally. And not only at sort of the central government level, but also folks like the GLAM sector, so museums and libraries and schools. Schools are a huge part of what we do here. So what we do is we go into schools, we'll do a workshop, we'll work with the Board of Trustees to ensure that what teachers create can be shared legally. So that is who we are, and that's what we do.
Okay, that's a good long history. How about we boil it down to one slide? How can we get the real picture of what really it was?
Yeah, so what it was complicated. What we were is we were a self-funded, hosted project with an advisory panel, a public lead, and 0.5 of a comms person. Initially, we were hosted by the Royal Society. And the Royal Society, wonderful, lovely people who are really not cheap to be a part of. So we had to pay them, it was like 108% of our budget in order to be hosted. Folks who have worked in a university setting are probably familiar with these sorts of overhead charges. And unfortunately, we weren't able to sustain that. So when we reached that point where we needed a new host who was a little bit more affordable, Wade McIntosh from the OR OERFU, raised his hand and said, we will be happy to host you. And so we moved over to being part of Otago Poly and under the OERF. And as you can see there, this created a somewhat complicated org chart where we had a public lead, we had a director, we had an advisory panel, we had an OERFU board, and then you have, of course, the public lead and the comms lead. So it was a complex little self-funded project.
Okay, well, complex sounds like there were some challenges there. Tell us what some of the internal challenges were.
So I've used the word self-funded a couple of times. Self-funded means that we were responsible for going out into the world and getting people to give us money, getting organizations to give us money. Mostly we were funded by the New Zealand government, but it actually turns out that it's incredibly challenging to get people to give you money when you don't legally exist. Without an organization behind you and without sort of the legal structures of that, it's almost impossible to fundraise effectively outside of government. So that was one of the challenges that we faced. It was also a little bit challenging having two boards. It was hard for us to set clear strategic directions. It was challenging for us to figure out sort of what our vision and mission was and where we fit in the context of Otago Poly, in the context of the OERFU. There were a lot of cooks sitting in that kitchen. And at the same time, back in those days, we followed the Creative Commons affiliate planning process, which was a fairly simple roadmap, which I think if you're sort of a small chapter or a club, probably works better than if you're an organization with employees, which is what we were. So we had a lot of challenges that we were facing that really were sort of generated because of the complex structure that we had.
Okay, so plenty of internal challenges there. What about externally?
Externally, the challenges that we faced were in some ways really genuinely opportunities, The biggest one was the CC Global Network transformation. For those of you who've been around the CC community, you're aware that that process started over 2 years ago. And the end result of that process was that they changed from the affiliate model with a memorandum of understanding to an entirely different model where you have individual membership and you have country chapters made up of individual members. And the thing that we were fit the old model reasonably well, but it didn't fit the new model particularly well. So what we had to do is try and figure out how we were going to deal with the cancellation of the MOU, the end of the affiliate model, and what we would look like under this new system.
Okay, so tell us about the incorporation story.
So all incorporation really is becoming a legal entity. And there's so much paperwork, like having just gone through it, oh my goodness. Here in New Zealand, there are different legal structures that you can choose. We worked with our board, we worked with our lawyer, we worked with an amazing organization called Accounting for Charities Trust. They also deal with accounting and governance issues. And what we decided is that we would become an incorporated society. So what that meant was that we needed to find 15 people who would sign on at a meeting. It meant that we needed to develop a set of rules that would govern the society. It meant that we have reporting requirements in terms of what we do with accounting. But it also meant that we could apply to become a charitable society or a charitable organization. And it meant that we could start fundraising from organizations who previously we simply, like, we didn't legally exist, so of course they wouldn't give us money. And the likelihood that they would give Otago Poly money was slim. So by incorporating, we opened up an entirely new source of funds, as well as the possibility of having this sort of entirely new legal existence.
Okay, so if we're looking at some of the news that we shared in the last month, we did manage to get some funding. So tell us about that. What funding were we able to get?
Yeah, so we've been really fortunate to sort of start out and that Stats New Zealand really is committed to our work. They're the ones who are responsible for ensuring that the open NZ goal and the open government framework, that all of that happens. And so they've really put their money where their mouth is in terms of supporting us. And I am not super at math, but they've given us like 231 for this year and then 175 in the future for next year. So they've taken us through 2020 with what's really going to be our core operating funding while we work on developing a model going forward that will keep us funded into the long term, because we believe in the work that we're doing. And we think that the work that we're doing is important work that people need to be paid to do. And so we're going to figure that out going forward. We've also had Internet New Zealand as a longtime supporter, and they have continued to support us through every step of this journey. I think probably without Internet New Zealand, we probably wouldn't continue to exist today. So our funders have been incredibly generous and incredibly supportive as we walked through what was really a huge transition for us as an organization.
Okay, so as that new organization, here we are at this new name, Toa Toa. What are we doing here with this new name? Tell us about that.
So under the previous system with Creative Commons, we operated under a memorandum of understanding. And that memorandum of understanding gave us the legal right to use the name Creative Commons. So when they canceled all of that, we're separate from the Creative Commons chapter. So we actually needed a new name. And what we decided to do is we threw it out to our community and we sought advice from them on what they thought that our name should be going forward. And Toa Toha is the Maori word for sharing. And what we really liked about that name is that it put the primacy of both Maori and indigenous rights sort of right at the center of our organization and ensured that going forward, that would continue to be at the center of our organization since it was literally in our name. So our hope is that by adopting this name, we would both signal our commitment to that particular community and also really embed it in our future.
Great. So tell us about that future now. What is the future holding for what Toa Toa's activities?
So in terms of what our activities are, we have to go back to that strategic plan that we're working our way through. It's a strategic plan that will take us through 2020. And a lot of what we're doing these days is education work. So we're focusing on going out into schools and delivering workshops, as well as doing meetings with boards of trustees to help them to adopt Creative Commons policies so that teachers can share materials. The Stats New Zealand Agreement contributes to that. And they also are helping to fund our work with the New Zealand Government Open Access and Licensing Framework. So what we're doing is offering workshops for public servants and for others that will allow them to come learn the importance of open access, learn the importance of open licensing, and also walk them through the sort of nitty-gritty, how do you actually do this and make this happen in your day-to-day life in whatever government department you're part of. At the same time, open data is something that's an absolutely crucial and important part of the work of the New Zealand government, as well as the New Zealand tech sector and others. And what we do is we're working to make sure that the licensing parts of that are well understood, widely understood, and that people are using Creative Commons licenses for those, because we think that that's the best legal mechanism for ensuring that your data is open and shareable. We also, of course, do advocacy work, like many small nonprofits. We're incredibly excited that we're going to be unveiling a new campaign where, for the first time in a New Zealand context at least, we're going to be engaging the public on issues of open access to scholarly information. Historically, this is a conversation that has mostly taken place inside of universities and with research funders, but we think that the public has both an interest in this and some really crucial organizing work needs to be done in order to move this forward. So we're going to be working on that. And of course, we have copyright reform as well on the agenda for us here in New Zealand. MB will be releasing their latest report, hopefully like any second now. And we'll be working to create submissions on that and to mobilize other parts of the community like Lianza, working with Internet New Zealand, and other folks who also have a strong interest in this copyright reform process to ensure that everyone's engaged and involved. And finally, and this is something that's actually really important to me and that I think we'll come back to in a moment, and that's making sure that we're engaging the community. What I have found as someone who's been involved for a really long time with this movement is that we don't always do the best job of welcoming others into it. We don't always have the best, I've sort of called them on-ramps to engagement. And what I want to do is work to make sure that we have the right on-ramps and that we're inviting a wider group than we previously have. We've approved a new communication strategy as part of that. And we've also are looking at doing some Pacific region advocacy because there's a lot of need for open licensing really throughout the Pacific. And we think that we're well placed to support those efforts.
Right. Well, I know that you personally believe that critique is very healthy for any movement. So tell us, Mandy, about your current thinking around what your critique on the open movement is.
Yeah, I mean, one of the longstanding critiques of the open movement has been that it's under-theorized. I think that when the movement's focus was more on building and sharing a particular legal tool, it was probably less important that we had some strong theoretical work behind it. But I think that as the movement is transitioning to being more political, if anyone's heard Ryan Merkley from CCHQ speak, they're being really quite explicit about this transition. I think that the need for a coherent underlying theory is much greater. I think that without it, it's much harder to build a shared understanding of what the movement is trying to accomplish. And for whom, like, right, for whom is this movement working? What sort of interpretation are we putting on open? And how can we ensure that we're not vulnerable to subversion within the movement? Which I think, if anyone's seen that recent job ad from a certain large publisher for someone working on open science, I think it's something that we really need to be cognizant of.
Okay, give us your perspective on power sharing and agenda setting.
Yeah, so what I found here in New Zealand and in the United States, which are the environments where I've worked in the open movement, is that we are very much a white, Western, relatively affluent, mostly glam sector workers and academic sort of movement. I think that we have a scattering of engaged artists. There are a few innovative business folks. But we've had some really limited engagement from the Global South and from other sorts of marginalized groups. And I think that Creative Commons HQ is the central organization within the open movement, has made some real genuine efforts to increase diversity and to create a welcoming environment. But I'm concerned that it's been doing so within the constraints of the larger goals of the movement. And I think it's also done so without a critical understanding of race and colonialism. I think that the underlying logic of the movement's push for diversity has been that the movement had a representational problem. And that you can solve a representational problem by just changing the numbers. But I think that the problem with that is that you end up with diversity for diversity's sake, and we've had really limited success with that. And I think it's also had really, I think it can come across as self-serving sometimes. I think that it can come across as being less out of a desire for offering allyship to marginalized populations, and more about spreading the gospel of open. So in other words, the diversity movement sort of within the open movement seems to me to be more about spreading the movement and less about supporting populations who have been harmed by the policies that we're trying to oppose. What I would like to see us do in order to build a movement that fulfills sort of our big rhetorical claims is that the open movement should rethink its relationship to marginalized populations, and to power structures, so that rather than working just to attract more diverse membership, what we should work on is sharing power with the folks who we wish to attract, including agenda setting, and being willing to really look at the goals of the movement and what we need to do to change those goals so that they're actually more attractive to folks who currently aren't interested in being involved. For us here in Aotearoa, that means taking really seriously critiques from Maori, and also questioning why is it that our organization doesn't currently and has not historically included non-white immigrants, New Zealanders of Chinese and Indian descent, or Pacific Islanders. I think that without support from these communities, and without a willingness to evolve our advocacy positions to those that align with the interest of those groups, I think we're going to continue to fall far short of our claimed desire to build a diverse movement. And more than that, I think that we're at real risk of perpetuating white supremacy in an inadvertent and unintentional way.
Okay, tell us about labor and material reality and your perspective on that.
So I think that as a movement, we really need to reconsider the value of labor and how we reward labor. And my hope is that Totowa can work on really looking closely at this and looking closely at other sorts of structures. So we're in an era right now where the workforce, both inside of academia and outside of it, are being converted to a sort of contract-based precariat, right? I think we're all familiar with that term. And I think that progressive organizations and movements have an obligation to take seriously the material needs of those for whom we claim to be advocating. So the Open Movement claims to work on behalf of a wide range of constituencies, right? Artists, academics, GLAM sector institutions. But I'm concerned that we've been doing so in such a narrow way that the actual material needs of these people and these institutions are sometimes shown disregard, both in terms of the policies that the movement supports and in the structure and culture of the movement itself. My hope is that Toʻitoha can work to change that. So one of the examples of that is the oft-repeated quip that I think we've all heard, that we're not responsible for developing new business models for the publishing industry. If we define the publishing industry as the big five oligarchic publishers, I think that everyone can get behind that statement. The problem is that because the movement as a whole hasn't really worked to develop or adopt a critique of structural inequality and power, our policy goals are really vulnerable to being corrupted. And I think that if we work to recenter the needs of small-scale creators, human-scale publishing industries or enterprises, and junior academics, and start paying attention to their actual material circumstances, we'll have a lot more success. And I think that we'll be able to grow more as a movement and hopefully achieve what our goals are. For us locally, that means responding, that means allying ourselves with organizations that prioritize supporting the groups that we want to attract. So unions, academic groups fighting neoliberalism, publishers that are working to explore alternative business models. I think more grassroots organizing to build solidarity among these groups and to offer support to their causes seems to me an effective growth strategy. I also think that some of the sort of longstanding comment or criticisms of Creative Commons and the Open Movement should probably be revisited, specifically the concerns around access to justice. I think that as organizations and as movements, we've sort of pushed access to justice over to the side. But I think recentering it and recognizing that when people say things like, but what can I do when someone violates my copyright? Or what can I do if I put a Creative Commons license on something and someone does something that I don't want them to do? It's probably something that we should take more seriously and come up with a better response than that's not our problem, which I think is too often, maybe not what we say, but I think it's what people hear. And the other thing that I would add is I think that within the open access movement, there's been a really sometimes disturbing reliance on unpaid labor and the donated labor of other organizations. And what we should probably do is look more seriously at how we can ensure that the right people are compensated for the work that they're doing for open access, and that that compensation is distributed sort of fairly across the movement and isn't, for example, going to folks at large, well-funded institutions who probably don't have the same level of need, right? And also making sure that some of that is going to the Global South and to other places around the world so that we can be a more global movement than we already are.
Are okay, so yeah, I'm here. I was going to say, do you have any other concerns?
I guess that the biggest one would be the theory of change overall for the sort of open access movement. I think that it would be useful if we evaluated what our theory of change is and maybe started tweaking it a bit in the hopes that we would be more strategically successful than we have been. So for example, for those of you who don't know, all political movements have a theory of change, right? It's a narrative about how the movement intends to go from the current state to the desired one. So the Creative Commons theory of change has relied on a legal technocratic solution, right? Copyright licenses. And the problem, and you can see that in the way that large publishers have adapted through the creation of gold open access and Arthur processing charges, is that technical solutions to political problems are vulnerable to subversion and corruption. Beyond the limitations sort of inherent in technical solutions, the framing of the movement around a specific strategy, openness, I think has also proven problematic. Openness can be really valuable in some contexts, but in others it can be detrimental. And framing a political movement around the concept of openness both serves to turn away those who might share the underlying goals, but it also limits the imagination of the movement in attempting to meet its goals through a wider range of strategies. At the same time, I think that the underlying ideas behind the licenses are really firmly based in a liberal understanding of the world that has been deeply influenced by Anglo values and by the American legal system. It's a world where private property structures social relations and rights are held by individuals. And I think that Creative Commons as a movement and sort of the open movement as a whole rarely, if ever, challenge these structures and ideas, but seek really explicitly to work within them. And the problem with that is that if you then want to attract people who work from different paradigms, it becomes much, much harder. I think in 2001, it probably made a lot of sense. But in 2018, I think that we can see the limitations of that approach. And it's really clear that we need to work to develop a new approach that's going to be broader and that's going to hopefully gain traction among people who previously weren't particularly engaged.
Okay, so what do you see will bring lasting and genuine change?
So I'm going to go with dismantling structures of power, but I'm completely open to people who have other ideas. Political change requires getting power, and then it requires using that power to achieve your goals. The tricky bit, as far as I see it, is how a movement works to get power, and then how it works to hold that power. I think that strategies that are likely to be effective require us to pay attention to sort of the general zeitgeist in the world and to ally with folks who want similar things to what you want. So one of the things that I think is extremely important is something that I think we usually call it building the infrastructure of open access, but you could also call it mutual aid. I think building a strong open access infrastructure that allows people to contribute directly, allows them to have some autonomy, allows them to build solidarity between researchers and readers and between teachers and students is going to be core going forward. I also think that we need to think really seriously about our views on Sci-Hub and sort of come to a position that at least acknowledges the reality that the practical thing that we were trying to solve, where people didn't have access to information, has in many ways been solved. It's just not been solved in sort of a long-term sustainable way. But I think that coming up with a better answer than the sort of throw your hands up that we've been doing as a movement would really help. But a lot of what we're interested in Toa is hearing from you and hearing from the public about what problems they face with access to information and with sort of openness on the internet, and what they would like to see going forward so that we can sort of co-create and co-create, hopefully, new structures that will allow us to move forward into a world where the internet's going to continue to be very important, but where the internet is also going to continue to be a profoundly dangerous sort of thing. Right? I'm an American in New Zealand, and there's a reason for that, and we can't say that the internet isn't a huge part of that. I also don't think that we can ignore what's actually happening in the world. I think that we need to think about climate change. I think that we need to think about the rise of authoritarianism, and not try and separate ourselves and sort of position ourselves as outside of all of these real world concerns, because I don't think that we are, right? So presumably, I have said enough stuff here that someone's got a question or two about it. I will go ahead and maybe turn my video off, but also let me see my screen again, and hand it over to, how about Brendan, and then Dione can close us off before we take questions.
Sure. All I was just going to contribute is that I think, thank very much for that overview, Mandy. It's been an enlightening one, even for me being so new to the organisation. I think from my perspective and from a comms perspective, one of the things that's going to be really important for making it clear what Toa Toa is all about are the stories that we tell about Toa Toa going forward and the people who are involved with it. I can share one thing, which is we're going to be having a story about towards the end of the month, is a new book that is coming out. Well, it's actually been published this month. It's a novel called Fishing for Maui, which is by New Zealand author Isa Ritchie, and it's going to be just the second novel in New Zealand to have been published under Creative Commons license, and the first will be available in the digital as well as print form. So it's going to be an interesting story in itself, because it's about food, family and mental illness and everything like that. And the author is 33-year-old. She works as a policy advisor in the public service, but it's got a very much a firm belief in about the freedom of information and that aspect to it. And she's hoping that the that this being a book being able to be shared more on digitally will mean that there's more of the stories around people dealing with mental health will be able to be shared wider. So that's going to be coming out before the end of the month. So we'll look forward to sharing that with you more, and other stories in the months ahead about people who are using the licenses, and I suppose bringing a bit more colour about what Toa Toa is all about. So Dione, I'll hand over to you.
Lovely. Thank you, Brendan. And yes, thank you again, Mandy, for that overview. It's always really, really helpful to hear that, even though I have been part of the organization for the last 4 months. And as a woman of color and as a New Zealander who has been very politically active in these areas, you know, open access and freedom of information, and access to that has often been limited and curtailed by a number of visible and invisible structures. And so it's really exciting to be part of an organization that has at its heart an emphasis on genuine sharing and is both self-conscious and self-aware of the world in which we live and how we can navigate those spaces. So just to close our presentation collectively, just with a quick karakia, ki runga, ki raro, Kiroto Kiwaho, Rire Rire Ho Pai Marie. Kia ora whanau for sharing with us, for listening to Mandy's presentation, and as a Ropu, as Toa Toa Te Ropu, we're very grateful for your listening, and we look forward to your questions. So over to you again, Mandy. Kia ora.
Excellent. And I will actually hand this back over to Jenny. Jenny, are you ready to take back over and hand us any questions you might have?
Yeah, great. Thank you very much, Mandy, Brendan and Dion. That was fantastic. Really, really interesting and, you know, visionary, I think, and important to see your plan for Toa Toa. It's very exciting to watch it from this side of the ditch. So I have a few questions I'd like to ask, and I will just encourage anyone else who wants to ask them to type them into the text box or the chat box, or if you've got stuff on Twitter, we'll just have a quick look at that, see if there's anything that's come out. So one thing that just strikes me, I'm not Australian, I'm also immigrant to Australia, as you know, and so not to this part of the world. So it strikes me, just looking at what you've done, is that there's something very particular about the New Zealand context that allows your organisation to succeed. And I just wondered if you could perhaps reflect on that a little bit and talk about what you'd perhaps like to see are the opportunities elsewhere, particularly in Australia, where there is a different context for sure.
Yeah, I think that in terms of the context that sort of defines New Zealand, is New Zealand is our founding document is really the treaty between Maori and between the Crown. And so I think that here it is politically easier to support Indigenous rights in a way that is harder in the United States, in I presume Australia, possibly less so in Canada. I think Canada is farther along that journey. But I think that as we attempt to co-create sort of an information system here, it not only makes sense, but it is absolutely required that you attend to the particular needs of Maori folks. And I think that that's part of what makes New Zealand a really amazing place to live, is that openness and that sort of baseline assumption that you're not going to screw this up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting, and I think that would be my perspective also, having seen it, that there is a very specific thing about the founding of New Zealand that makes it different. I think there are also, it's very interesting that there's been support from outside of the university sector for what you do, particularly, you know, financial support previously, financial support now. So I guess one thing, again, just thinking about it, the area where the Australasian Open Access Strategy Group has primarily focused its work thus far has been within the university sector and within the scholarly publishing sector, not really in schools and such like that you do. What's been the response from the university sector to what you're trying to do? Does this resonate with what their plans are, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we work closely. We work really closely, I think, with the folks in the university, certainly Te Whera. I think we work reasonably closely with Canterbury, with Otago, not so much with Vic. And I think we work closely with the University of Auckland, but I think they've got their own sort of internal challenges that are happening right now. I think that the universities do this reasonably well. I think that it makes sense to put some emphasis on research funders. And I think that it probably also makes sense to work to ensure that everyone is actually engaged, right? Scholars don't do what they do to talk to each other. A lot of times they're doing what they do because they want to influence industry, or they want to say something useful so you can build a thing, or they're working with the health world. There's this sort of whole range of folks outside the university who are deeply invested in having access to scholarly information. And I don't think it makes sense to overlook them. I think that if you put too much emphasis on the folks who produce it as the consumers of it, you end up overlooking this incredibly powerful part of the world that is like the rest of the world. And I'll say, this is the first job I've had where I didn't work in a university since I was like a counter girl at a Mexican restaurant a long time ago. And there's like a lot of people who don't work at universities and they care about this stuff. And I think that talking to them is likely to be a politically successful strategy.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, actually. And one of the things that always strikes me is when you talk to people outside of universities about the current system of scholarly communication, they just kind of go, well, that's insane. I mean, you know, how on earth do you have such a system? So I think it's, talking directly out to people to the outside of the universities, I think is potentially really powerful. So I've got a question I'm just going to read out. So from Wayne McIntosh. So he says, thanks, teams, for leading a bold and important mission. In the context of open, what are the power structures that need to be dismantled in order to achieve the vision of open, in your opinion? So which power structures are you going after?
I think that that's a challenging question, in part because I think it depends on what exactly we want to define as a sort of structure of power. I think that probably the most important ones that we need to think about when thinking about information is the role that corporations play in it, and the role that corporations play in terms of owning information so that the rest of us can't use it. And at the same time, I think that we also need to look at people's material support. I think that as a movement, one of the things that we have sort of stepped away from in ways that I don't think are helpful to us is the reality that people write and people produce because they hope that it will feed them. And I think that when we come up with solutions, they need to be solutions that attend to people's actual material needs. So structures of power around who gets money, how they get that money, why some people get money and other people don't get money would be a pretty big part of it.
Yeah, I would think that's a great point. And I was very much taken with your point about the need to, you know, that there is the infrastructure overall, which includes people's time. It is very important that we actually build that into the costs of the open movement. It, you know, because by the very fact that people can't, you know, if they donate their labor, then you're excluding a whole range of people that can't afford to donate their labour. And I think it is, that's been completely ignored thus far. Okay, so I've got another question from Amanda Lawrence at APO. So she's asking, what kind of theories do you think are the most fruitful to use for the open movement? And if open is problematic, I'm putting inverted commas around that, what should we be calling this movement?
So I come from sort of both in terms of my previous writing and previous work, the critical librarianship movement. There's all sorts of critical whatever movements. And so that's where I come from. And that's where I would look for theories that make sense. The other part of it, and I think that critical librarianship is moving more and more in this direction. For a while, it was very... For a while, it was very theory-based. And we're talking about open or critical pedagogy, those sorts of things. Looking also to how other movements have done activist work, I think is really important. One of the things that I think that we've overlooked is basic principles of organizing, right? How do you get power? Who decides who gets power? What do you do to take power when you don't have it? I think that's where I would be inclined to look. But that said, I think that there's a lot of room for really interesting work to happen here, both in universities and sort of outside in, in the libraries is probably the right place. So that what we're doing is building coherent sorts of theories that allow us to do both an understanding so that we understand how power works within the movement, how power works in the thing that we're critiquing, so it's sort of the overall publishing industry, and also how we do effective organizing work around this so that we can actually get some power so that we can affect change. Oh, and as for what we should call it, I think that's a really good question. I've seen critical openness talked about. I think that the open branding has some real challenges, especially because of its relationship to the open source world. So one of the things that has been most challenging about this role is every other job I've had back to that Mexican counter girl role I used to have, has been in a library. And there are indeed men in libraries, but it is not the same. When you step out of the library world and you start working in the tech world, oh my goodness gracious. I don't know many people who would be particularly motivated to come from libraries into that community. And I don't know that using language that seems to ally us with that community is particularly useful. As long as that's a community where it's really hard for women and other sorts of marginalized folks to actually operate. So I don't know what we should call it, but like, I'm down for coming up with something new.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And of course, within scholarly publishing, talking to academics about open access nowadays, that can be highly problematic because it's associated with predatory publishing or high article processing charges, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I think for one of the terms that is increasingly being used is fair in all its kind of meanings, so findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable, but also fair as in socially fair, and all the different flavours of that. And I don't know if that's going to take off in the same way, but I think it's absolutely the case that changing the names is going to be helpful. I think it'll also widen debate. So if anyone has a great name, please do let us know. I think it would be...
One of the things that I would actually add there too is I think that the open access movement is a little bit policy wonky. Like, I think that one of the things that we want to talk about are like, let's talk about detailed policies, and we forget about talking about values. So I think that by moving away from that sort of open access framing, we're also able to move away from a let's talk about nitty-gritty details like author processing charges and green versus gold open access and hybrid and... we can have more interesting conversations that invite more people into the conversation because we're talking about things that they understand, like morals and values and fairness and equality and things that are much harder to talk about in a conversation that has for so long been about author processing charges and those sorts of things.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Amanda's got another question, but I'll take chair's privilege to kind of say one other thing, which is that I've probably been in the open access movement about as long as you have, Mandy. And at the very beginning, when we talked to academics about acts information as a public good and the social side of it, it was incredibly hard to engage them. So the discussion almost had to turn around to talk about what the benefits and incentives were for academics. And I think we're now in this rather interesting space where we can have both of those conversations, and both need to happen probably. Okay, so I've got two more questions. I'll move through these. So the first one from Amanda again. So she said, have you got thoughts on how we connect up this movement with others such as the Sustainable Development Goals and Access to Information, or the Open Government Partnership, or RDA, by which I presume you mean Research Data Alliance, which there are many RDAs. And she notes that she sits on the fringes of all of these, but doesn't hear much connection across them. Although I would just point out that ALIA in Australia has got a good program with regard to the Sustainable Development Goals. But anyway, so over to you, Mandy, about those thoughts.
Well, I don't know much about Sustainable Development Goals, but I do know about open government. I know a little bit about RDA. And I think, I mean, we're involved with the Open Government Partnership process here in New Zealand. Dione has been attending those workshops on our behalf. I think that this has to go back to the power sharing and agenda setting. I think that in order for us to sort of engage in that way, we have to be willing to change what we're doing. And we have to be willing to let those folks into our movement and to let them really have more control over our organizations than we have. Historically, I think that that we haven't really done a super job with that.
Okay, great. And then the next question is from Lukman Hayes. So this is also just leading on from your point about in the need for Indigenous perspectives, from especially from the Pacific, to shape the open movement. So he asked, what engagement has Toa had thus far with Maori, for instance, in terms of this? And by shaping, he means by helping to decolonize the movement.
So one of the things that I've done is I have hired someone specifically to work on this. Historically, I think that we have had this idea that this is just work that people should do out of the goodness of their hearts because they think it's important, because they care about our movement. And I am less convinced of that. I think that this is real, genuine work that people should be paid to do. And I am going to hand this question off to the person who I paid to do that. Dione, would you like to add something here?
Absolutely. So I think what Mandy's referring to is being really active, you know, and having agency in creating a space where I feel very welcome to offer my perspectives. I'm a New Zealand of French Caribbean descent, raised in Aotearoa, married into a Maori family, and very fluent with kaupapa Maori. And one of the main things my role involves is inviting other Maori people into these conversations in active ways. So for example, Tuatua has started developing relationships with Te Mana Rauranga. Vanessa Clark is a huge part of that movement, where they look at Indigenous data and especially relating and identifying data as part of a nation's taonga. We're also starting to work with the museums and especially people who are in the Indigenous digital literacy section. And we are slowly collating a database of Indigenous and Pacifica artists who are also going to be able to use in material ways the information that we can facilitate. So it's quite important, I think, that kōrero and conversation and dialogue isn't limited to people at the top, but rather it's a circular and a form of sharing where people feel that their voice is valued and can add value to a conversation, which is again why Mandy asked me to attend the OPG workshops, both in Auckland and also in Wellington, where it was really interesting to see the diversity in the room, which was really none, a bar myself, two other Maori and one and two other young Pacifica people. The diversity at the level of conversation when we're moving into the higher echelons of the public sector, for example, are not really reflective of the people who need to be in the room. So we are both working at intellectual levels and cerebral levels, but we're also working actively within the community and within the environment in which to make those changes. Hopefully, Lachman, that answers some of your questions. Handing it back to you, Mandy.
Excellent. All right.
That's a great, Yeah, it's great to hear that. I think it's a really refreshing take on this whole need to sort of change the movement is very good to hear. I had one question really, which was, I guess, is more for advice outwards, and then we'll probably wrap up, which is that what would you like to see other organisations doing to help support what you're doing, both within New Zealand and also potentially within Australia as well?
Well, within New Zealand, I think that showing up is really important. There's an enormous number of opportunities to engage with these sorts of processes, both through government and through conferences. And I think as much as possible, engaging in these conversations in New Zealand is really important. And then I think if we take it globally, this is a movement that needs to do some real work around how we invite new people into the movement, who we aren't inviting into the movement. I think we need to look around our tables and ask ourselves, who isn't here and what do we need to change about ourselves to get them here?
Great. Okay. Well, on that fantastic point, I think I'll call this to a close. Mandy, Brendan and Dion, thanks so much for your presentation. I think it was fantastic and I think we've had some really good discussions afterwards. Really looking forward to what happens next and very happy obviously to participate in any way that we can from over here. So thank you very much everyone, and this will be up on our website, so please keep the conversation going.
Excellent. Thanks everyone. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kia ora.